Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary, or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
As working-class Americans struggled with high inflation, corporate profits soared to a record high in 2021, reaching nearly $3 trillion. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Sharon Zhang, journalist. This article is published under the heading Corporate Profits Reached Record High of Nearly $3 Trillion in 2021. Here's more. As working-class Americans struggled with high inflation, corporate profits soared to a record high in 2021, reaching nearly $3 trillion. Data from the Department of Commerce's Bureau of Economic Analysis shows that pre-tax profits over the whole year increased by a whopping 25%, reaching $2.8 trillion. The annualized rate of profits from the fourth quarter was even higher at $2.94 trillion. The boost in profits exceeds the 7% inflation for consumer prices, bolstering arguments that companies are raising prices beyond inflation rates in order to pad their profits. Meanwhile, hourly wages for U.S. workers increased by about 4.7% last year, which is equivalent to a pay cut of about 2.4%. Experts say that the record profits are evidence that inflation isn't a concern for corporations. Clearly, mega corporations could easily absorb the higher cost of goods and services right now, wrote Robert Reich, former labor secretary and economics professor at the University of California, Berkeley. They're not raising prices because they have to. They're doing it because with so few competitors, they can. The problem at its core is corporate greed. Indeed, corporate executives have admitted on earnings calls with shareholders that they're not afraid to exploit inflation and current crises like the pandemic. Our business operates the best when inflation is about 3% to 4%, Kroger CEO Rodney McMullen told investors last June, adding, "A little bit of inflation is always good in our business." Other corporate executives have lied about their reasons for raising prices. As CBS reported, Tyson's CEO told shareholders that the company is only raising prices on meat products in order to cover inflation costs for the company. However, it posted profits of $1 billion in the first quarter of 2022, a 48% raise over the same period last year. Lawmakers have proposed legislation to rein in runaway profits. Last year, Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a bill that would have created a minimum tax rate of 15% in order to prevent companies from paying $0 in taxes or a negative tax rate thanks to corporate subsidies. Other recent proposals have been aimed directly at current profits. Last week, Senator Bernie Sanders unveiled his corporate windfall profits tax, which would levy a 95% tax on corporate profits that exceed pre-pandemic levels for companies that make more than $500 million in profits yearly. The tax resembles policies that the U.S. put in place during the First and Second World Wars and Korean War to discourage companies from profiteering from the conflicts. Sanders said in a press release on the bill, "We cannot allow big oil companies and other large profitable corporations to continue to use the war in Ukraine, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the specter of inflation to make obscene profits by price gouging Americans at the gas pump, the grocery store, or any other sector of the U.S. economy." He added, "During these troubling times, the working class cannot bear the brunt of this economic crisis, while corporate CEOs, wealthy shareholders, and the billionaire class make out like bandits."
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of supplication of Abu Hamza Thumali. And we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. أو لعلك فقدتني من مجالس العلماء فخذلتني أو لعلك رأيتني في الغافلين فمن رحمتك آيستني أو لعلك رأيتني يخالف مجالس البطالين فبيني وبينهم خليتني أو لعلك لم تحب أن تسمع دعائي فباعدتني أو لعلك بجرمي وجريرتي كافيتني أو لعلك بقلة حيائي منك جازيتني.
In this part of Dua Abu Hamza Thumali, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says, لَعَلَّكَ فَقَدْتَنِي مِنْ مَجَالِسِ الْعُلَمَاءِ فَخَذَلْتَنِي. Perhaps I stopped visiting the gatherings of the scholars, so you forsook me. أَوْ لَعَلَّكَ رَأَيْتَنِي فِي الْغَافِلِينَ فَمِنْ رَحْمَتِكَ آيَسْتَنِي. Or perhaps I sat in the company of the forgetful careless, so you withdrew your mercy. We said that Imam alayhi salam is talking about the reasons behind our failures, the consequences of our actions, and the fact that our past actions can contribute to the emergence and somehow deprivation of us from the opportunities of worshipping. And the fact that we must understand is that if we want to succeed in sincere supplication and servitude, we must provide the preliminaries beforehand, because we cannot find the desired state in our supplications and in our prayers without preconditioning our hearts. The heart has the role of giving out guidance that receives from Allah, and it gives out the guidance. Our heart and our qalb, its action is similar to the twofold function of the physical heart, which pumps the blood in and out. Our soul is also the same. It has twofold action. And committing sins deprive the man of the sweetness of remembrance because they invert the heart.
Ramadan, 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 Ramadan.
The Ocean of Dua by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Volitional actions done by man in this world have two outcomes. One outcome manifests itself in this world, and the other outcome will surface in the next world. The mundane outcome of good actions done by a person is the opportunity to perform more good deeds. Conversely, the repercussion of the wicked acts and actions being committed leads to the deprivation of the opportunity to do good deeds. Sometimes they even cause stronger inclination to committing more sins. That is why Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is saying that we must avoid doing wicked actions. When you learn that there are these kinds of relationships happening each and every day in our lives, we can pay attention to these consequences, and paying attention to these prompts us to be watchful of our actions and always be wary of God. This is what we call taqwa and piety. Not to eat prohibited food, not to talk about anything without preconditioning of our heart and our tongue, without thinking, not to do everything thoughtlessly. In fact, we must always take the pleasure of God into consideration. This is the true meaning of servitude.
You are the servant. You are to do as your God tells you to do. You are to prohibit as your God tells you to prohibit, and you do not have to question him in this regard. Why do I have to eat this? Only because my Lord has told me to do so. Not because it has these kinds of benefits. It might also be acceptable to do our deeds, to bring our deeds to the presence of the Lord to be accepted, if we have this kind of intention in our minds. But the true meaning of servitude is to do them, to do good deeds and prohibit the wicked actions only because he had said so. That is why not everyone is admitted to an intimate meeting. There are many Muslims who do not have this opportunity to have intimacy with God. Only those who are truly wary of their actions, only those who are truly wary of their behaviors and interactions with others, and always remembering God, those are the ones that are admitted to an intimate meeting with God. Those are the ones whose hearts have not been inverted, and they have kept themselves away from the things Allah has prohibited. This is what Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is teaching us by this beautiful supplication. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The month of Ramadan has begun for Muslims around the world. However, some struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. Palestinians are facing a new round of escalations while being subjected to a blockade. The number of Palestinians killed so far this week has reached 10. The Gaza Strip-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the West Bank-headquartered Palestinian Authority have slammed the Israeli regime over its earlier targeted killing of Palestinian youths. In a statement, Palestinian presidential spokesman Nabil Abu Radena said the ongoing escalation would blow up the situation in Palestine and the entire region. This came after Israel's occupation forces shot dead three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday, amid the escalation of Israeli violence in the Palestinian territories. Israeli forces assassinated the trio by opening fire on their vehicle near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. They later seized the vehicle and the bodies of the three people. Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, identified the victims as its members. Palestinian resistance groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas have vowed that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished.
If the Israelis see Ramadan as an opportunity when Palestinians, especially Palestinians who are associated with resistance groups, if they see this as an opportunity for them to be gathered with their families, then they become targets, and their families become targets. So this is unfortunately something for the Israelis. This may be considered an opportunity to be more repressive than usual.
Palestinians were brutally attacked by Israeli regime forces at the Damascus gate of the occupied Al-Quds on the second night of the holy month of Ramadan as well. It is customary for Israeli forces to exhibit increased levels of violence against Palestinians gathering in the area during the fasting month of Ramadan. At least 20 Palestinians were injured in the clashes and 10 were detained. Israeli forces have recently intensified their violent raids on Palestinian cities and villages. A fresh escalation erupted after Palestinian gunmen, angry over the regime's crimes and occupation, killed 11 Israelis in separate attacks. That's the sharpest spike in attacks on city streets in years. On Tuesday, a Palestinian shot dead five people in a suburb of Tel Aviv before he was killed by Israeli forces. The operation came days after two Palestinian gunmen killed two Israeli forces and wounded four others in a shooting attack in the northern Israeli city of Hadera before being shot dead. The latest round of escalations could lead to igniting another war between Israel and Palestine. Last year, protests against the illegal eviction of Palestinians from the homes in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah during Ramadan ignited an 11-day Israeli offensive on Gaza in May. At least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment. On the Israeli side, 12 people, including two children, were killed.
What's needed in order to do real resistance there is to make Israel extremely uncomfortable, and to the extent that they have to change their policies, or basically just hopefully it'll be so uncomfortable that they'll have to leave, which is of course what happened in Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, and in Algeria. The occupier left. And this needs to be the goal for Palestinians in order to the goal of their resistance.
The Israeli regime has for years guaranteed its security by attacking Palestinians, but now things have changed and Palestinian people and resistance groups are ready to retaliate. A Turkish prosecutor has requested to hold the trial for Jamal Khashoggi's murder in Istanbul and transfer it to Saudi Arabia, some 4 years after the dissident Saudi journalist was murdered in Turkey. The court requested the Justice Ministry's opinion on the issue and is expected to rule on the request at its next hearing, set for April 7th. The Saudi Chief Public Prosecutor's Office had requested the transfer, and evidently the Turkish courts are planning to comply. Turkey's justice minister said earlier that his ministry would approve a request to transfer a trial over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia. Human rights groups have condemned the move, saying Riyadh cannot be expected to hold a fair trial for the alleged killers of the journalist. In 2020, Saudi Arabia jailed 8 people for between 7 and 20 years for Khashoggi's murder. None of the defendants was named in what rights groups described as a sham trial. Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. A U.S. intelligence report released a year ago said Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had approved the operation to kill Khashoggi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said the murder had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government, an accusation that has already strained the relations between the two countries and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish goods, which cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. The request by the Turkish prosecutor comes as Turkey seeks to mend ties with Saudi Arabia.
The Saudis absolutely have both an economic and a political interest in further ties to Turkey and Erdogan. I think it is a relationship where both of them are looking to get out of their tough situations, both politically and economically. There is political devastation and economic devastation, specifically in Turkey, and there is an economic, clear economic interest to Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia and various other figures in both Saudi Arabia and Turkey to increase these ties that are beneficial for the United States and for other Western vassal states in the Middle East.
Turkish-Saudi relations have remained strained since Khashoggi's murder and dismemberment in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. With the announcement that Turkish courts will no longer seek to hold Khashoggi's murderers accountable, it seems clear that Erdogan has decided to prioritize his political future over the pursuit of justice in the Khashoggi killing. In recent months, Erdogan has spoken of improving ties with Saudi Arabia, hoping that better relations will help Turkey recover from an economic crisis that has left it struggling with 50% inflation. He apparently is hoping to attract financial support and investment from Saudi Arabia as well as the UAE for Turkey's inflation-ravaged economy. Turkish and Emirati leaders recently visited each other's capitals, ending a decade of hostility culminating in Abu Dhabi's announcement that it intended to make $10 billion in new investments in Turkey. In addition to his efforts to improve ties with the Saudis and Emiratis, Erdogan has also looked to improve relations with Israel. The recent visit to Ankara by Israeli President Isaac Herzog signals a reset in Erdogan's stance.
Turkey is trying to view a new balance of power in the Middle East and in relations with all the countries around them. Turkey has always, when it comes to global geopolitics, tried to play both sides. They've been on both sides where they have economic ties in Russia, economic ties and political ties to the United States. And in the Middle East, there has always been a complicated nature of Turkey's relationship to Islamist groups throughout the Middle East, and that entire situation has showed that Turkey doesn't maybe necessarily want to be in the middle ground any longer. And it seems that in this era of rising tensions and changing relations, Erdogan and Turkey is trying to position themselves in a possible place where Western ties and economic benefits shift the balance of power in the region.
Given the emerging degree of cooperation between Israel, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and the US, Erdogan's recent efforts to pursue closer ties with each of these countries may reflect not only his interest in winning foreign investment, but his strategic calculation about the future balance of power in the region.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massey, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with the country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions. As the U.S. takes aim at Russia, it leaves itself vulnerable to the possible ricochet. U.S. House Representative Thomas Massey agrees, saying the Western sanctions on Russia haven't been thought through. Massey says American farmers who are being cut off from Russia's fertilizers will be hit hard. But that's not all. Russia and Ukraine account for about a quarter of the world's wheat production combined. A prolonged conflict and sanctions on Russia will take a toll on the world's food supply, potentially exposing hundreds of millions to hunger around the world. The price of the sanctions is also being paid at the pumps, especially in the West, with fuel prices soaring to new highs, pushing up the inflation rate in countries like the UK to figures not seen in decades. Numerous academic studies have been conducted on the effectiveness of economic sanctions. They all indicate that the punitive measures do little other than hurt the ordinary citizens.
Sanctions are going to hurt Russia, and they're going to hurt everybody, you know? And Russia has learned to live with sanctions and got along okay, and maybe even better. They've learned to replace some of the things they depended upon. So whatever damage is going to be done to Russia, there is going to be equal or greater damage done to the other side of the sanctions.
Why insist on entering a game that won't have any real winners? Is inflicting pain on a rival worth taking equally, if not more painful, punches?
Afghanistan has suffered crisis after crisis over the past decades, but the situation has perhaps never been so grave. Afghan people now have to live with the terrible mess left after so many years of war. There is no doubt that most of the problems facing the South Asian nation have their roots in war. The United States and its Western allies have been widely criticized for their 20-year military campaign, which wreaked havoc in the country but failed to achieve its stated goals. Afghanistan is now at a critical point. It has turned into a historic test for the international community. This week, top diplomats from Afghanistan's neighboring countries gathered in China for their third conference on the situation. They seem to understand better than other countries what is at stake if Afghanistan fails completely. The foreign ministers of neighboring countries called on the Taliban to adopt further measures to improve living conditions and guarantee the basic rights of all Afghans, including women and ethnic minorities. The foreign ministers also renewed their call on the Taliban to form an inclusive government.
I think that there's potential significance in it if they can manage to produce the aid. And not only money aid, but if they can organize food shipments and fuel shipments and this sort of thing into Afghanistan and pressure for equitable distribution where it's necessary, then of course this conference could save Afghanistan.
Iran, which is hosting several million Afghan refugees, said during the conference that neighboring and friendly countries should strengthen cooperation in the reconstruction of Afghanistan and boost assistance to its people without political considerations. At the conference in China, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian proposed a security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by the neighbors. He also stressed that the root cause of problems in Afghanistan is the long-term occupation and misguided policies of the occupiers, mainly the United States. Afghanistan is grappling with an endless list of problems months after the chaotic withdrawal of the United States. The story of Afghanistan today is unending suffering for its people. Poverty and hunger have worsened nationwide. According to the World Food Program, 95% of Afghans do not have enough food to eat. Many millions of Afghan children face life-threatening levels of hunger. Meanwhile, outbreaks of deadly diseases among children are rife as the Afghan population cannot access adequate health care and routine vaccinations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres once again raised the alarm about the situation.
Without immediate action, we face a starvation and malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. People are already selling their children and their body parts in order to feed their families. Afghanistan's economy has effectively collapsed. There is very little cash. More than 80% of the population are in debt.
Afghanistan has been reliant on foreign financial aid for a very long time. But the need for financial resources has never been so serious. Afghanistan's massive humanitarian crisis has its roots in foreign restrictions on its banking sector. U.S. sanctions on the Taliban have left international banks wary of allowing aid groups to transfer funds into the country. Meanwhile, the U.S. decision to keep billions of dollars in frozen Afghan funds held in the U.S. is being blamed for a large part of the crisis. Calls have been growing on the United States to immediately release the sum it seized from Afghanistan's central bank, causing a devastating hunger crisis. All eyes are on the U.S. now to see if it realizes the need to change course and move in line with those who are truly concerned about the situation in Afghanistan.
In the limelight.
Scientists with the United Nations Weather Agency have expressed fresh concern over the climate crisis following recent extreme events in Antarctica, an area they say should not be taken for granted. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Andrea Germanos, journalist. This article is published under the heading UN Weather Agency Sounds Alarm on Extreme Events in Antarctica. Here's the details. We'll be right back. Scientists with the United Nations Weather Agency have recently expressed fresh concern over the climate crisis following recent extreme events in Antarctica, an area they say should not be taken for granted. The remarks from climate experts with the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, delivered just ahead of a key report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, follow last month's collapse of East Antarctica's Kangir Ice Shelf, record warm temperatures and rare rainfall. Mike Sparrow, head of WMO co-sponsored World Climate Research Program, said in a statement, Antarctica has often been referred to as sleeping giant, the coldest, windiest, and driest continent and often thought of as being relatively stable. However, he continued, recent temperature extremes and ice shelf collapses have reminded us that we shouldn't take Antarctica for granted. The Antarctic ice sheets hold almost 60 meters of potential sea level rise. Understanding and properly monitoring the continent is therefore crucial for society's future well-being, said Sparrow. Catherine Walker, an Earth and planetary scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute and NASA, made a similar point about East Antarctica. Walker said to NASA's Earth Observatory, "All of the previous collapses have taken place in West Antarctica, not East Antarctica, which until recently has been thought of as relatively stable. This is something like a dress rehearsal for what we could expect from other, more massive ice shelves if we continue to melt and destabilize," she said, adding, "Then we will really be past the turnaround point in terms of a slowing sea level rise." The unprecedented high temperatures that hit the region last month were the result of an atmospheric river that originated near southeast Australia and spread warmth-trapping clouds and moisture well inhaled land across East Antarctica, as meteorologist Bob Henson wrote at Yale Climate Connections. It was, in fact, freakish warming at Earth's South Pole, as he put it. Henson explained, "At Vostok, a Russian weather station launched in 1958, the high of 17.7 degrees Celsius on March 18th smashed the record for any March by 26.8 degrees Fahrenheit and came in roughly 63 degrees Fahrenheit above the average daily high. The 26.8 degrees Fahrenheit represents the largest margin in world history for breaking a monthly record at any site with at least 40 years of data, according to Maximiliano Herrera, an expert on international weather records. It's also the only time Vostok has gotten above zero Fahrenheit outside of December or January, never mind mid-March. Vostok's all-time high is 14 degrees Celsius. About 350 miles away on Turin, an elevation roughly similar to Vostok, the French-Italian research site Concordia Station, that is staffed year-round, as is the case for Vostok, set its all-time record high of 11.5 degrees Celsius on March 17th. Data has been collected year-round at this site only since 2005, a period too brief for an all-time record to carry too much weight. However, the reading was a mind-blowing 67 degrees Fahrenheit above the daily average high of around 49 degrees Celsius, that is about 56 degrees Fahrenheit. Etienne Vignon and Christophe Genton, experts with WMO Global Cryosphere Watch put the temperatures at Concordia, located in an area known as Dome C, in the context of the March rainfall and pointed to wide reverberations of such changes. The warm temperature at Dome C, still much below freezing, is probably more a wake-up call, not having significant local impact in the inner ice sheet. On the other hand, the fact that the temperature was way above 0 degrees Celsius and that it rained at the coast upstream the previous day is more of a concern, said Vignan and Genton, both with France's Laboratoire, that is dynamic. They added that rainfall is rare in Antarctica, but when it occurs, it has consequences on ecosystems, particularly on penguin colonies and on the ice sheet mass balance. While there are no penguin chicks at this time of the year, Vignan and Genton cautioned that the fact that this happens now in March is a reminder of what is at stake in the peripheral regions, wildlife, stability of the ice sheet. They said, here, the warm temperature at Dome C is a source of excitement for climatologists. That it rains at the coast in March is a source of concern for everyone, they said. The comments on the Antarctic developments came ahead of the expected Monday release of the IPCC's Working Group 3 report on climate mitigation. That report will land at a crucial time, according to Greenpeace. As countries, businesses, and investors must recalibrate plans for a faster transition away from fossil fuels towards climate justice and truly sustainable, more resilient food systems. News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INEC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. A zoo in Ireland's capital, Dublin, has unveiled its newest habitat called the Himalayan Hills, a brand new home of the red panda and the snow leopard. Visitors are able to see the red panda's habitat by traveling along the new trail around a rocky edge to an open viewing area. The red pandas are typically climbing, exploring, or munching on bamboo at the top of broad-leafed evergreen trees. The expanded habitat was designed with a red panda's tree-dwelling lifestyle in mind. Also, visitors can gaze up at the 15-meter rocky slope through an impressive panoramic viewing area to spot the snow leopards. These elusive felines are typically nocturnal, so catching a glimpse of one is a rare treat.
Yeah, the animals are settling in well. We've tried to recreate the wild habitat in the Himalayan hills. Both species live quite high up. In case of the snow leopards, up to 5,000 meters on these very steep rocky slopes, which you can see here in the habitat as well. We've tried to use the topology of Dublin Zoo.
The project took a few years to complete. It was halted in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic and massive budget shortages, but was restarted after government funding in 2021. The zoo is part of a protection project for red pandas and snow leopards. These animals are listed as vulnerable due to threats from poaching and severe habitat loss. Ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
A super rare birth has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction. The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic lights out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future, and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village, known today as the Takalik Abaj Archaeological Park, was occupied for 1,700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land, where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Takalik Abaj is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even minor spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or other senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Iranian families celebrated the ancient tradition of Sizdebedar, or Nature's Day, by spending some quality time outdoors with family. Yusuf Jalali has a story.
It's Nature's Day in Iran, and parks and countrysides are flooded with families who never miss the chance to spend the final day of Nowruz holidays out with their loved ones. The ancient occasion is called Sizdebedar. Over the past 2 years, the festival was called off amid the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the first time in 2 years that Sizdebedar is marked with such a huge crowd.
Because of the coronavirus, people could not go out on Sizdebedar for 2 years in a row. And this year, the majority are vaccinated and green spaces are jam-packed with picnic goers.
We Iranians have grown up with Sizdebedar and we never miss it. Thank God we can safely enjoy this amazing tradition this year with all our family members and relatives.
Sizdabedar means getting rid of number 13. In Persian mythology, 13 is the bad luck number. Now Sizdabedar is believed to chase away the bad luck and bring good vibes.
Today, we cooked special foods like ash and chicken kebab to eat them for lunch with our family members. We traditionally believe that this day brings bad luck and we must spend it outdoors with joy to get rid of it.
The event is also called the Festival of Nature, and it is an occasion to raise awareness of the need to preserve the environment.
Throughout the history, Iranians have had close relationship with nature, and that's why we have dedicated a special day in our calendar to nature. Before we leave our place here, we clean the environment.
Sizdabedar is the final day of the two-week celebrations of the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz, which marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. The tradition has been celebrated for some 3,000